Part 4. Wherein the chief grounds of the reasonings of Armenians, in support and defense of the aforementioned notions of liberty, moral agency, etc., and against the opposite doctrine, are considered. Section I. The essence of the virtue and vice of dispositions of the heart and acts of the will, lies not in their cause, but their nature. One main foundation of the reasons, which are brought to establish the forementioned notions of liberty, virtue, vice, etc., is a supposition, that the virtuousness of the dispositions, or acts of the will, consists not in the nature of these dispositions or acts, but wholly in the origin or cause of them, so that if the disposition of the mind, or acts of the will, be never so good, yet if the cause of the disposition or act be not our virtue, there is nothing virtuous or praiseworthy in it. And, on the contrary, if the will, in its inclination or acts, be never so bad, yet unless it arises from something that is our vice or fault, there is nothing vicious or blameworthy in it. Hence their grand objection and pretended demonstration, or self-evidence, against any virtue and commendableness, or vice and blameworthiness, of those habits or acts of the will, which are not from some virtuous or vicious determination of the will itself. Now, if this matter be well considered, it will appear to be altogether a mistake, yea, a gross absurdity. And that it is most certain, that if there be any such things as a virtuous or vicious disposition, or volition of mind, the virtuousness or viciousness of them consists not in the origin or cause of these things, but in the nature of them. If the essence of virtuousness or commendableness, and of viciousness or fault, does not lie in the nature of the dispositions or acts of mind, which are said to be our virtue or our fault, but in their cause, then it is certain it lies nowhere at all. Thus, for instance, if the vice of a vicious act of will lies not in the nature of the act, but the cause, so that its being of a bad nature will not make it at all our fault, unless it arises from some faulty determination of ours, as its cause, or something in us that is our fault. Then, for the same reason, neither can the viciousness of that cause lie in the nature of the thing itself, but in its cause, that evil determination of ours is not our fault, merely because it is of a bad nature, unless it arises from some cause in us that is our fault. And when we are come to this higher cause, still the reason of the thing holds good. Though this cause be of a bad nature, yet we are not at all to blame on that account, unless it arises from something faulty in us. Nor yet can blameworthiness lie in the nature of this cause but in the cause of that. And thus we must drive faultiness back from step to step, from a lower cause to a higher, in infinitum. And that is thoroughly to banish it from the world, and to allow it no possibility of existence anywhere in the universality of things. On these principles, vice, or moral evil cannot exist in anything that is in effect. Because fault does not consist in the nature of things, but in their cause. As well as because effects are necessary, being unavoidably connected with their cause, therefore the cause only is to blame. And so it follows, that faultiness can lie only in that cause, which is a cause only, and no effect of anything. Nor yet can it lie in this. For then it must lie in the nature of the thing itself. Not in its being from any determination of ours, nor anything faulty in us, which is the cause, nor indeed from any cause at all. For, by the supposition, it is no effect, and has no cause. And thus he that will maintain it is not the nature of habits or acts of will that makes them virtuous or faulty, but the cause, must immediately run himself out of his own assertion. And, in maintaining it, will insensibly contradict and deny it. This is certain, that if effects are vicious and faulty, not from their nature, or from anything inherent in them, but because they are from a bad cause, it must be on account of the badness of the cause. A bad effect in the will must be bad, because the cause is bad, or of an evil nature, or has badness as a quality inherent in it, and a good effect in the will must be good, by reason of the goodness of the cause, or its being of a good kind and nature. And if this be what is meant, the very supposition of fault and praise lying not in the nature of the thing, but the cause, contradicts itself, and does at least resolve the essence of virtue and vice into the nature of things, and supposes it originally to consist in that. And if a caviller has a mind to run from the absurdity, by saying, no, the fault of the thing, which is the cause, lies not in this, that the cause itself is of an evil nature, but that the cause is evil. In that sense, that it is from another bad cause, still the absurdity will follow him. For if so, then the cause before charged is at once acquitted, and all the blame must be laid to the higher cause, and must consist in that's being evil, or of an evil nature. So now we are come again to lay the blame of the thing blameworthy, to the nature of the thing, and not to the cause. And if any is so foolish as to go higher still, and ascend from step to step, till he is come to that which is the first cause concerned in the whole affair, and will say, all the blame lies in that. Then, at last, he must be forced to own, that the faultiness of the thing which he supposes alone blameworthy, lies wholly in the nature of the thing, and not in the original or cause of it. For the supposition is, that it has no original, it is determined by no act of ours, is caused by nothing faulty in us, being absolutely without any cause. And so the race is at an end, but the evader is taken in this flight. It is agreeable to the natural notions of mankind, that moral evil, with its desert of dislike and abhorrence, and all its other ill deservings, consists in a certain deformity in the nature of certain dispositions of the heart and acts of the will, and not in the deformity of something else, diverse from the very thing itself, which deserves abhorrence, supposed to be the cause of it. Which would be absurd, because that would be to suppose the thing that is innocent and not evil, is truly evil and faulty, because another thing is evil. It implies a contradiction. For it would be to suppose, the very thing which is morally evil and blameworthy, is innocent and not blameworthy. But that something else, which is its cause, is only to blame. To say, that vice does not consist in the thing which is vicious, but in its cause, is the same as to say, that vice does not consist in vice, but in that which produces it. It is true a cause may be to blame for being the cause of vice, it may be wickedness in the cause that it produces wickedness. But it would imply a contradiction, to suppose that these two are the same individual wickedness. The wicked act of the cause in producing wickedness, is one wickedness. And the wickedness produced, if there be any produced, is another. And therefore the wickedness of the latter does not lie in the former, but is distinct from it. And the wickedness of both lies in the evil nature of the things which are wicked. The thing which makes sin hateful, is that by which it deserves punishment, which is but the expression of hatred. And that which renders virtue lovely, is the same with that on the account of which it is fit to receive praise and reward, which are but the expressions of esteem and love. But that which makes vice hateful, is its hateful nature. And that which renders virtue lovely, is its amiable nature. It is a certain beauty or deformity that are inherent in that good or evil will, which is the soul of virtue and vice and not in the occasion of it, which is their worthiness of esteem or disesteem, praise or dispraise, according to the common sense of mankind. If the cause or occasion of the rise of a hateful disposition or act of will be also hateful, suppose another antecedent evil will, that is entirely another sin, and deserves punishment by itself, under a distinct consideration. There is worthiness of dispraise in the nature of an evil volition, and not wholly in some foregoing act, which is its cause. Otherwise the evil volition, which is the effect, is no moral evil, any more than sickness, or some other natural calamity, which arises from a cause morally evil. Thus, for instance, ingratitude is hateful and worthy of dispraise, according to common sense. Not because something as bad, or worse than ingratitude, was the cause that produced it, but because it is hateful in itself, inherent deformity. So, the love of virtue is amiable and worthy of praise, not merely because something else went before this love of virtue in our minds, which caused it to take place there. For instance, our own choice. We choose to love virtue, and, by some method or other, wrought ourselves into the love of it. But because of the amiableness and condescendency of such a disposition and inclination of heart. If that was the case, that we did choose to love virtue, and so produced that love in ourselves, this choice itself could be no otherwise amiable or praiseworthy, than as love to virtue, or some other amiable inclination, was exercised and implied in it. If that choice was amiable at all, it must be so on account of some amiable quality in the nature of the choice. If we chose to love virtue, not in love to virtue, or anything that was good and exercised no sort of good disposition to the choice itself was not virtuous nor worthy of any praise, according to common sense, because the choice was not of a good nature. It may not be improper here to take notice of something said by an author that has lately made a mighty noise in America. A necessary holiness says he is no holiness. Adam could not be originally created in righteousness and true holiness, because he must choose to be righteous, before he could be righteous and therefore he must exist, he must be created. Yea, he must exercise thought and reflection, before he was righteous. There is much more to the same effect in that place, and also in pages 437, 438, 439, 440. If these things are so, it will certainly follow that the first choosing to be righteous is no righteous choice. There is no righteousness or holiness in it, because no choosing to be righteous goes before it. For he plainly speaks of choosing to be righteous as what must go before righteousness. And that which follows the choice, being the effect of the choice, cannot be righteousness or holiness. For an effect is a thing necessary, and cannot prevent the influence or efficacy of its cause. And therefore is unavoidably dependent upon the cause. And he says a necessary holiness is no holiness. So that neither can a choice of righteousness be righteousness or holiness, nor can anything that is consequent on that choice, and the effect of it, be righteousness or holiness. Nor can anything that is without choice, be righteousness or holiness. So that by this scheme, all righteousness and holiness is at once shut out of the world, and no door left open by which it can ever possibly enter into the world. I suppose the way that men came to entertain this absurd inconsistent notion, with respect to internal inclinations and volitions themselves or notions that imply it, namely that the essence of their moral good or evil lies not in their nature, but their cause, was, that it is indeed a very plain dictate of common sense, that it is so with respect to all outward actions and sensible motions of the body. That the moral good or evil of them does not lie at all in the motions themselves, which, taken by themselves, are nothing of a moral nature. And the essence of all the moral good or evil that concerns them, lies in those internal dispositions and volitions which are the cause of them. Now, being always used to determine this, without hesitation or dispute, concerning external actions, which are the things that, in the common use of language, are signified by such phrases as men's actions, or their doings. Hence, when they came to speak of volitions, and internal exercises of their inclinations, under the same denomination of their actions, or what they do, they unwarily determined the case must also be the same with these as with external actions, not considering the vast difference in the nature of the case. If any shall still object and say, why is it not necessary that the cause should be considered, in order to determine whether anything be worthy of blame or praise, is it agreeable to reason and common sense, that a man is to be praised or blamed for that which he is not the cause or author of, and has no hand in? I answer such phrases as being the cause, being the author, having a hand, and the like, are ambiguous. They are most vulgarly understood for being the designing voluntary cause, or cause by antecedent choice. And it is most certain that men are not, in this sense, the causes or authors of the first act of their wills, in any case, as certain as anything is or ever can be. For nothing can be more certain than that a thing is not before it is, nor a thing of the same kind before the first thing of that kind, and so no choice before the first choice, as the phrase, being the author, may be understood, not of being the producer by an antecedent act of will, but as a person may be said to be the author of the act of will itself, by his being the immediate agent, or the being that is acting, or an exercise in that act. If the phrase of being the author is used to signify this, then doubtless common sense requires men's being the authors of their own acts of will, in order to their being esteemed worthy of praise or dispraise, on account of them. And common sense teaches, that they must be the authors of external actions, in the former sense, namely, their being the causes of them by an act of will or choice, in order to their being justly blamed or praised, but it teaches no such thing with respect to the acts of the will themselves. But this may appear more manifest by the things which will be observed in the following section. Section E. The falseness and inconsistency of that metaphysical notion of action and agency which seems to be generally entertained by the defenders of the Armenian doctrine concerning liberty, moral agency, etc. One thing that is made very much a ground of argument and supposed demonstration by Armenians, in defense of the forementioned principles concerning moral agency, virtue, vice, etc., is their metaphysical notion of agency and action. They say, unless the soul has a self-determining power, it has no power of action. If its volitions be not caused by itself, but are excited and determined by some extrinsic cause, they cannot be the soul's own acts. And that the soul cannot be active, but must be wholly passive, in those effects which it is the subject of necessarily, and not from its own free determination. Mr. Chubb lays the foundation of a scheme of liberty, and of his arguments to support it, very much in this position, that man is an agent, and capable of action, which doubtless is true, but self-determination belongs to his notion of action, and is the very essence of it. Whence he infers, that it is impossible for a man to act and be acted upon, in the same thing, at the same time. And that nothing that is an action, can be the effect of the action of another, and he insists, that a necessary agent, or an agent that is necessarily determined to act, is a plain contradiction. But those are a precarious sort of demonstrations, which men build on the meaning that they arbitrarily affix to the word. Especially when that meaning is abstruse, inconsistent, and entirely diverse from the original sense of the word in common speech. That the meaning of the word action, as Mr. Chubb and many others use it, is utterly unintelligible and inconsistent, is manifest, because it belongs to their notion of an action, that it is something wherein is no passion or passiveness. That is, according to their sense of passiveness, it is under the power, influence, or action of no cause. And this implies, that action has no cause, and is no effect. For to be an effect implies passiveness, or the being subject to the power and action of its cause. And yet they hold, that the mind's action is the effect of its own determination. Yea, the mind's free and voluntary determination, which is the same with free choice. So that action is the effect of something preceding, even a preceding act of choice, and consequently, in this effect, the mind is passive, subject to the power and action of the preceding cause, which is the foregoing choice, and therefore cannot be active. So that here we have this contradiction, that action is always the effect of foregoing choice, and therefore cannot be action, because it is passive to the power of that preceding causal choice. And the mind cannot be active and passive in the same thing, at the same time. Again, they say, necessity is utterly inconsistent with action, and a necessary action is a contradiction. And so their notion of action implies contingence, and excludes all necessity. And, therefore, their notion of action implies, that it has no necessary dependence or connection with anything foregoing. For such a dependence or connection excludes contingence, and implies necessity. And yet their notion of action implies necessity, and supposes that it is necessary, and cannot be contingent. For they suppose, that whatever is properly called action, must be determined by the will and free choice. And this is as much as to say, that it must be necessary, being dependent upon, and determined by, something foregoing, namely, a foregoing act of choice. Again, it belongs to their notion of action, of that which is a proper and mere act, that it is the beginning of motion, or of exertion of power, but yet it is implied in their notion of action, that it is not the beginning of motion or exertion of power, but is consequent and dependent on a preceding exertion of power, namely the power of will and choice. For they say there is no proper action but what is freely chosen, or, which is the same thing, determined by a foregoing act of free choice. But if any of them shall see cause to deny this, and say they hold no such thing, as that every action is chosen or determined by a foregoing choice, but that the very first exertion of will only, undetermined by any preceding act, is properly called action, then I say, such a man's notion of action implies necessity. For what the mind is the subject of, without the determination of its own previous choice, it is the subject of necessarily, as to any hand that free choice has in the affair, and without any ability the mind has to prevent it by any will or election of its own. Because, by the supposition, It precludes all previous acts of will or choice in the case, which might prevent it. So that it is again, in this other way, implied in their notion of act, that it is both necessary and not necessary. Again, it belongs to their notion of an act, that it is no effect of a predetermining bias or preponderation, but springs immediately out of indifference. And this implies that it cannot be from foregoing choice, which is foregoing preponderation if it be not habitual, but occasional, yet if it cause the act, it is truly previous, efficacious, and determining. And yet, at the same time, it is essential to their notion of the act, that it is what the agent is the author of, freely and voluntarily, and that is by previous choice and design. So that, according to their notion of the act, considered with regard to its consequences, these following things are all essential to it. Namely that it should be necessary, and not necessary. That it should be from a cause, and no cause. That it should be the fruit of choice and design, and not the fruit of choice and design. That it should be the beginning of motion or exertion, and yet consequent on previous exertion. That it should be before it is. That it should spring immediately out of indifference and equilibrium, and yet be the effect of preponderation. That it should be self-originated, and also have its original from something else. That it is what the mind causes itself, of its own will, and can produce or prevent, according to its choice or pleasure, and yet what the mind has no power to prevent, precluding all previous choice in the affair, so that an act, according to their metaphysical notion of it, is something of which there is no idea. It is nothing but a confusion of the mind, excited by words, without any distinct meaning, and is an absolute non-entity. And that in two respects. 1. There is nothing in the world that ever was, is, or can be, to answer the things which must belong to its description, according to what they suppose to be essential to it. And 2. There neither is, nor ever was, nor can be, any notion or idea to answer the word, as they use and explain it. 4. If we should suppose any such notion, it would many ways destroy itself. But it is impossible any idea or notion should subsist in the mind, whose very nature and essence which constitutes it, destroys it. If some learned philosopher, who had been abroad, in giving an account of the curious observations he had made in his travels, should say, he had been in Terra del Fuego, and there had seen an animal, which he calls by a certain name, that begat and brought forth itself, and yet had a sire and dam distinct from itself. That it had an appetite, and was hungry before it had a being. That his master, who led him, and governed him at his pleasure, was always governed by him, and driven by him where he pleased. That when he moved, he always took a step before the first step. That he went with his head first, and yet always went tail foremost. And this, though he had neither tail nor head, it would be no impudence at all to tell such a traveler, though a learned man, that he himself had no notion or idea of such an animal as he gave an account of, and never had, nor ever should have. As the forementioned notion of action is very inconsistent, so it is wholly diverse from the original meaning of the word. The more usual signification of it, in vulgar speech, seems to be some motion or exertion of power, that is voluntary, or that is the effect of the will, and is used in the same sense as doing. And most commonly it is used to signify outward actions. So thinking is often distinguished from acting, and desiring and willing from doing. Besides this more usual and proper signification of the word action, there are other ways in which the word is used that are less proper, which yet have place in common speech. Oftentimes it is used to signify some motion or alteration in inanimate things, with relation to some object and effect. So, the spring of a watch is said to act upon the chain and wheels. The sunbeams, to act upon plants and trees. And the fire, to act upon wood. Sometimes the word is useful to signify motions, alterations, and exertions of power, which are seen in corporeal things, considered absolutely. Especially when these motions seem to arise from some internal cause which is hidden. So that they have a greater resemblance of those motions of our bodies which are the effects of natural volition, or invisible exertions of will. So, the fermentation of liquor, the operations of the lodestone, and of electrical bodies, are called the action of these things. And sometimes, The word action is used to signify the exercise of thought, or of will and inclination, so meditating, loving, hating, inclining, disinclining, choosing, and refusing, may be sometimes called acting. Though more rarely unless it be by philosophers and metaphysicians than in any of the other senses. But the word is never used in vulgar speech in that sense which Armenian divines use it in, namely, for the self-determinate exercise of the will, or an exertion of the soul, that arises without any necessary connection with anything foregoing. If a man does something voluntarily, or as the effect of his choice, then, in the most proper sense, and as the word is most originally and commonly used, he is said to act. But whether that choice or volition be self-determined, or no, whether it be connected with foregoing, habitual bias, whether it be the certain effect of the strongest motive, or some intrinsic cause, never comes into consideration in the meaning of the word. And if the word action is arbitrarily used by some men otherwise, to suit some scheme of metaphysics or morality, no argument can reasonably be founded on such a use of this term, to prove anything but their own pleasure. For divines and philosophers strenuously to urge such arguments, as though they were sufficient to support and demonstrate a whole scheme of moral philosophy and divinity, is certainly to erect a mighty edifice on the sand, or rather on a shadow. And though it may now perhaps, through custom, have become natural for them to use the word in this sense, if that may be called a sense or meaning, which is inconsistent with itself, yet this does not prove that it is agreeable to the natural notions men have of things, or that there can be anything in the creation that should answer such a meaning. And though they appeal to experience, yet the truth is, that men are so far from experiencing any such thing, that it is impossible for them to have any conception of it. If it should be objected, that action and passion are doubtless words of a contrary signification. But to suppose that the agent, in its action, is under the power and influence of something intrinsic, is to confound action and passion, and make them the same thing. I answer, that action and passion are doubtless, as they are sometimes used, words of opposite signification, but not as signifying opposite existences, but only opposite relations. The words cause and effect are terms of opposite signification. But, nevertheless, if I assert that, the same thing may, at the same time, in different respects and relations, be both cause and effect, this will not prove that I confound the terms. The soul may be both active and passive in the same thing in different respects. Active with relation to one thing, and passive with relation to another. The word passion, when said in opposition to action, or rather activeness, is merely a relative. It signifies no effect or cause, nor any proper existence. But is the same with passiveness, or A being passive, or A being acted upon by something, which is a mere relation of a thing to some power or force exerted by some cause, producing some effect in it or upon it. An action, when set properly in opposition to passion, or passiveness, is no real existence. It is not the same with an action, but as a mere relation it is the activeness of something on another thing, being the opposite relation to the other, namely a relation of power, or force, exerted by some cause towards another thing, which is the subject of the effect of that power. Indeed, the word action is frequently used to signify something not merely relative, but more absolute, and a real existence. As when we say an action, when the word is not used transitively, but absolutely, for some motion or exercise of body or mind, without any relation to any object or effect, and as used thus, it is not properly the opposite of passion, which ordinarily signifies nothing absolute, but merely the relation of being acted upon. And therefore, if the word action be useful in the like relative sense, then action and passion are only two contrary relations. And it is no absurdity to suppose, the contrary relations may belong to the same thing, at the same time, with respect to different things. So, to suppose that there are acts of the soul by which a man voluntarily moves, and acts upon objects, and produces effects which yet themselves are effects of something else, and wherein the soul itself is the object of something acting upon, and influencing that, does not at all confound action and passion. The words may nevertheless be properly of opposite signification. There may be as true and real a difference between acting and being caused to act, though we should suppose the soul to be both in the same volition, as there is between living and being quickened, or made to live. It is no more a contradiction to suppose that action may be the effect of some other cause besides the agent or being that acts, than to suppose that life may be the effect of some other cause, besides the liver, or the being that lives, in whom life is caused to be. The thing which has led men into this inconsistent notion of action, when applied to volition, as though it were essential to this internal action, that the agent should be self-determined in it, and that the will should be the cause of it, was probably this, that, according to the sense of mankind, and the common use of language, it is so, with respect to men's external actions, which are what originally, and according to the vulgar use and most proper sense of the word, are called actions. Men in these are self-directed, self-determined, and their wills are the cause of the motions of their bodies, and the external things that are done. So that unless men do them voluntarily, and of choice, and the action be determined by their antecedent volition, it is no action or doing of theirs. Hence some metaphysicians have been led unwarily, but exceeding absurdly, to suppose the same concerning volition itself, that also must be determined by the will, which is to be determined by antecedent volition, as the motion of the body is, not considering the contradiction it implies. But it is very evident that in the metaphysical distinction between action and passion, though long since become common in the general vogue, due care has not been taken to conform language to the nature of things, or to any distinct, clear ideas. As it is in innumerable other philosophical, metaphysical terms, used in these disputes, which has occasioned inexpressible difficulty, contention, error, and confusion. And thus probably it came to be thought that necessity was inconsistent with action, as these terms are applied to volition. First, these terms, action and necessity, are changed from their original meaning, as signifying external voluntary action and constraint, in which meaning they are evidently inconsistent, to signify quite other things, namely volition itself, and certainty of existence. And when the change of signification is made, care is not taken to make proper allowances and abatements for the difference of sense. But still the same things are unwarily attributed to action and necessity, in the new meaning of the words, which plainly belong to them in their first sense. And on this ground, maxims are established without any real foundation, as though they were the most certain truths, and the most evident dictates of reason. But, however strenuously it is maintained, that what is necessary cannot be properly called action, and that a necessary action is a contradiction, yet it is probable there are few Armenian divines, who, if thoroughly tried, would stand to these principles. They will allow that God is, in the highest sense, an active being, and the highest fountain of life and action. And they would not probably deny that those that are called God's acts of righteousness, holiness, and faithfulness are truly and properly God's acts, and God is really a holy agent in them. And yet, I trust, they will not deny that God necessarily acts justly and faithfully, and that it is impossible for him to act unrighteously and unholy. Section E. The reasons why some think it contrary to common sense to suppose those things which are necessary to be worthy of either praise or blame. It is abundantly affirmed and urged by Armenian writers that it is contrary to common sense and the natural notions and apprehensions of mankind to suppose otherwise than that necessity making no distinction between natural and moral necessity is inconsistent with virtue and vice, praise and blame, reward and punishment. And their arguments from hence have been greatly triumphed in, and have been not a little perplexing to many, who have been friendly to the truth, as clearly revealed in the Holy Scriptures. It has seemed to them indeed difficult to reconcile Calvinistic doctrines with the notions men commonly have of justice and equity. And the true reasons of it seem to be these that follow. I. It is indeed a very plain dictate of common sense that natural necessity is wholly inconsistent with just praise or blame. If men do things which in themselves are very good, fit to be brought to pass, and very happy effects, properly against their wills, and cannot help it, or do them from a necessity that is without their wills, or with which their wills have no concern or connection, then it is a plain dictate of common sense that it is none of their virtue, nor any moral good in them, and that they are not worthy to be rewarded or praised, or at all esteemed, honored, or loved on that account. And, On the other hand, that if, from like necessity, they do those things which in themselves are very unhappy and pernicious, and do them because they cannot help it, the necessity is such, that it is all one whether they will them or no. And the reason why they are done, is from necessity only, and not from their wills. It is a very plain dictate of common sense, that they are not at all to blame. There is no vice, fault, or moral evil at all in the effect done. Nor are they who are thus necessitated, in any wise worthy to be punished, hated, or in the least disrespected, on that account. In like manner, if things, in themselves good and desirable, are absolutely impossible, with a natural impossibility, the universal reason of mankind teaches, that this wholly and perfectly excuses persons in their not doing them. And it is also a plain dictate of common sense, that if the doing things in themselves good, or avoiding things in themselves evil, is not absolutely impossible, with such a natural impossibility, but very difficult, with a natural difficulty, that is, a difficulty prior to, and not at all consisting in, will and inclination itself, and which would remain the same, let the inclination be what it will. Then a person's neglect or omission is excused in some measure, though not wholly. His sin is less aggravated than if the thing to be done were easy. And if instead of difficulty and hindrance, there be a contrary natural propensity in the state of things to the thing to be done, or effect to he brought to pass, abstracted from any consideration of the inclination of the heart. Though the propensity be not so great as to amount to a natural necessity, yet being some approach to it, so that the doing the good thing be very much from this natural tendency in the state of things, and but little from a good inclination. Then it is a dictate of common sense, that there is so much the less virtue in what is done. And so it is less praiseworthy and rewardable. The reason is easy, namely because such a natural propensity or tendency is an approach to natural necessity. And the greater the propensity, still so much the nearer is the approach to necessity. And, therefore, as natural necessity takes away or shuts out all virtue, so this propensity approaches to an abolition of virtue. That is, it diminishes it. And, on the other hand, natural difficulty, in the state of things, is an approach to natural impossibility. And as the latter, when it is complete and absolute, wholly takes away blame, so such difficulty takes away some blame, or diminishes blame, and makes the thing done to be less worthy of punishment. Men, in their first use of such phrases as these, must, cannot help it, cannot avoid it, necessary, unable, impossible, unavoidable, irresistible, etc., use them to signify a necessity of constraint or restraint, a natural necessity or impossibility, or some necessity that the will has nothing to do in, which may be, whether men will or no, and which may be supposed to be just the same, let men's inclinations and desires be what they will. Such kind of terms, in their original use, I suppose, among all nations, are relative, carrying in their signification, as was before observed, a reference or respect to some contrary will, desire, or endeavor, which, it is supposed, is, or may be, in the case. All men find, and begin to find in early childhood, that there are innumerable things that cannot be done, which they desire to do, and innumerable things, which they are averse to, that must be, they cannot avoid them, they will be, whether they choose them or no. It is to express this necessity, which men so soon and so often find, and which so greatly and early affects them in innumerable cases, that such terms and phrases are first formed. And it is to signify such a necessity, that they are first used, and that they are most constantly used, in the common affairs of life. And not to signify any such metaphysical, speculative, and abstract notion, as that connection in the nature or course of things, which is between the subject and predicate of a proposition, and which is the foundation of the certain truth of that proposition. To signify which, they who employ themselves in philosophical inquiries into the first origin and metaphysical relations and dependencies of things, have borrowed these terms, for want of others. But we grope from our cradles in a use of such terms and phrases entirely different from this, and carrying a sense exceeding diverse from that in which they are commonly used in the controversy between Arminians and Calvinists. And it being, as was said before, a dictate of the universal sense of mankind, evident to us as soon as we begin to think, that the necessity signified by these terms, in the sense in which we first learn them, does excuse persons and free them from all fault or blame. Hence our idea of excusableness or faultlessness is tied to these terms and phrases by a strong habit, which is begun in childhood, as soon as we begin to speak, and grows up with us, and is strengthened by constant use and custom, the connection growing stronger and stronger. The habitual connection which is in men's minds between blamelessness and those aforementioned terms, must, cannot, unable, necessary, impossible, unavoidable, etc., becomes very strong. Because as soon as ever men begin to use reason and speech, they have occasion to excuse themselves from the natural necessity signified by these terms, in numerous instances, I cannot do it. I could not help it. And all mankind have constant and daily occasion to use such phrases in this sense, to excuse themselves and others, in almost all the concerns of life, with respect to disappointments and things that happen, which concern and affect ourselves and others, that are hurtful, or disagreeable to us or them, or things desirable, that we or others fail of. That a being accustomed to an union of different ideas, from early childhood, makes the habitual connection exceeding strong, as though such connection were owing to nature, is manifest in innumerable instances. It is altogether by such an habitual connection of ideas, that men judge of the bigness or distance of the objects of sight, from their appearance. Thus, it is owing to such a connection early established, and growing up with a person, that he judges a mountain, which he sees at 10 miles distance, to be bigger than his nose, or further off than the end of it. Having been used so long to join a considerable distance and magnitude with such an appearance, men imagine it is by a dictate of natural sense, whereas, it would be quite otherwise with one that had his eyes newly opened, who had been born blind. He would have the same visible appearance, but natural sense would dictate no such thing, concerning the magnitude or distance of what appeared. Yea. When men, after they had been so habituated to connect ideas of innocency or blamelessness with such terms, that the union seems to be the effect of mere nature, come to hear the same terms used, and learn to use them themselves, in the forementioned new and metaphysical sense, to signify quite another sort of necessity, which has no such kind of relation to a contrary supposable will and endeavor. The notation of plain and manifest blamelessness, by this means, is, by a strong prejudice, insensibly and unwarily transferred to a case to which it by no means belongs, the change of the use of the terms, to a signification which is very diverse, not being taken notice of, or adverted to, and there are several reasons why it is not. L. The terms, as used by philosophers, are not very distinct and clear in their meaning if you use them in a fixed, determined sense. On the contrary, their meaning is very vague and confused, which is what commonly happens to the words used to signify things intellectual and moral, and to express what Mr. Locke calls mixed modes. If men had a clear and distinct understanding of what is intended by these metaphysical terms, they would be able more easily to compare them with their original and common sense, and so would not be so easily led into delusion by any sort of terms in the world, as by words of this sort. 2. The change of the signification of the terms is the more insensible, because the thing signified, though indeed very different, yet do in some generals agree. In necessity, that which is vulgarly so called, there is a strong connection between the thing said to be necessary, and something antecedent to it in the order of nature. So there is also in philosophical necessity. And though in both kinds of necessity the connection cannot be called by that name, with relation to an opposite will or endeavor, to which it is superior, which is the case in vulgar necessity. Yet, in both the connection is prior to will and endeavor, and so, in some respect, superior. In both kinds of necessity, there is a foundation for some certainty of the proposition that affirms the event, the terms used being the same, and the things signified agreeing in these and some other general circumstances. And the expressions, as used by philosophers, being not well defined, and so of obscure and loose signification. Hence persons are not aware of the great difference in the notions of innocence or faultiness, which were so strongly associated with them, and were strictly united in their minds, ever since they can remember, remain united with them still, as if the union were altogether natural and necessary. and they that go about to make a separation, seem to them to do great violence, even to nature itself. If another reason why it appears difficult to reconcile it with reason, that men should be blamed for that which is necessary with a moral necessity, which, as was observed before, is a species of philosophical necessity, is, that for want of due consideration, men inwardly entertain that apprehension, that this necessity may be against men's wills and sincere endeavors. They go away with that notion, that man may truly will, and wish, and strive, that it may be otherwise, but that invincible necessity stands in the way. And many think thus concerning themselves. Some, that are wicked men, think they wish that they were good, that they love God and holiness, but yet do not find that their wishes produce the effect. The reasons why men think so, are as follow. 1. They find what may be called an indirect willingness to have a better will, in the manner before observed. For it is impossible, and a contradiction, to suppose the will to be directly and properly against itself. And they do not consider, that this indirect willingness is entirely a different thing from properly willing the thing that is the duty and virtue required, and that there is no virtue in that sort of willingness which they have. They do not consider, that the volitions which a wicked man may have that he love God, are no acts of the will at all against the moral evil of not loving God, but only some disagreeable consequences. But the making the requisite distinction requires more care of reflection and thought than most men are used to. And men, through a prejudice in their own favor, are disposed to think well of their own desires and dispositions, and to account them good and virtuous, though their respective virtue be only indirect and remote, and it is nothing at all that is virtuous that truly excites or terminates their inclinations. 2. Another thing that insensibly lends and beguiles men into a supposition that this moral necessity or impossibility is, or may be, against men's wills and true endeavors, is the derivation and formation of the terms themselves, that are often used to express it, which is such as seems directly to point to, and holds this forth. Such words, for instance, as unable, unavoidable, impossible, irresistible, which carry a plain reference to a supposable power exerted, endeavors used, resistance made, in opposition to the necessity. And the persons that hear them, not considering nor suspecting but that they are used in their proper sense. That sense being therefore understood, there does naturally, and as it were necessarily, arise in their minds a supposition, that it may be so indeed, that true desires and endeavors may take place, but that invincible necessity stands in the way, and renders them vain and to no effect. V. Another thing, which makes persons more ready to suppose it to be contrary to reason, that men should be exposed to the punishments threatened to sin, for doing those things which are morally necessary, or not doing those things morally impossible, is, that imagination strengthens the argument, and adds greatly to the power and influence of the seeming reasons against it, from the greatness of that punishment to allow that they may be justly exposed to a small punishment, would not be so difficult. Whereas, if there were any good reason in the case, if it were truly a dictate of reason, that such necessity was inconsistent with faultiness, or just punishment, the demonstration would be equally certain with respect to a small punishment, or any punishment at all, as a very great one. But it is not equally easy to the imagination. They that argue against the justice of damning men for those things that are thus necessary, seem to make their argument the stronger, by setting forth the greatness of the punishment in strong expressions that a man should be cast into eternal burnings, that he should be made to fry in hell to all eternity, for those things which he had no power to avoid, and was under a fatal, unfrustrable, invincible necessity of doing. Section IV. It is agreeable to common sense, and the natural notions of mankind, to suppose moral necessity to be consistent with praise and blame, reward and punishment. Whether the reasons that have been given, why it appears difficult to some persons to reconcile with common sense the praising or blaming, rewarding or punishing those things which are morally necessary, are thought satisfactory, or not. Yet it most evidently appears, by the following things, that if this matter be rightly understood, setting aside all delusion arising from the impropriety and ambiguity of terms, this is not at all inconsistent with the natural apprehensions of mankind, and that sense of things which is found everywhere in the common people, who are furthest from having their thoughts perverted from their natural channel, by metaphysical and philosophical subtleties, but, on the contrary, altogether agreeable to, and the very voice and dictate of, this natural and vulgar sense. 1. This will appear, if we consider what the vulgar notion of blameworthiness is. The idea which the common people, through all ages and nations, have of faultiness, I suppose to be plainly this. A person's being or doing wrong, with his own will and pleasure. Containing these two things: 1. His doing wrong when he does as he pleases to. His pleasures being wrong. Or, in other words, perhaps more intelligibly expressing their notion, a person's having his heart wrong, and doing wrong from his heart. And this is the sum total of the matter. The common people do not ascend up in their reflections and abstractions to the metaphysical sources, relations, and dependencies of things, in order to form their notion of faultiness or blameworthiness. They do not wait till they have decided by their refinings what first determines the will, whether it be determined by something extrinsic or intrinsic, whether volition determines volition, or whether the understanding determines the will, whether there be any such thing as metaphysicians mean by contingence if they have any meaning, whether there be a sort of a strange, unaccountable sovereignty in the will, in the exercise of which, by its own sovereign acts, it brings to pass all its own sovereign acts. They do not take any part of their notion of fault or blame from the resolution of any such question. If this were the case, there are multitudes, yea, the far greater part of mankind, 999 out of 1,000, would live and die without having any such notion as that of fault ever entering into their heads, or without so much as one having any conception that anybody was to be either blamed or commended for anything. To be sure, it would be a long time before men came to have such notions. Whereas it is manifest, they are some of the first notions that appear in children, who discover, as soon as they can think, or speak, or act at all as rational creatures, a sense of desert. And certainly, in forming their notion of it, they make no use of metaphysics. All the ground they go upon consists in these two things: experience, and a natural sensation of a certain fitness or agreeableness which there is in uniting such moral evil as is above described, viz., a being or doing wrong with the will, and resentment in others, and pain inflicted on the person in whom this moral evil is. Which natural sense is what we call by the name of conscience. It is true, the common people and children, in their notion of any faulty act or deed, of any person, do suppose that it is the person's own act and deed. But this is all that belongs to what they understand by a thing's being a person's own deed or action. Even that it is something done by him of choice, that some exercise or motion should begin of itself, does not belong to their notion of an action or doing. If so, it would belong to their notion of it, that it is something which is the cause of its own beginning. And that is as much as to say, that it is before it begins to be. Nor is their notion of an action, some motion or exercise that begins accidentally, without any cause or reason, for that is contrary to one of the prime dictates of common sense, namely, that everything that begins to be, has some cause or reason why it is. The common people, in their notion of a faulty or praiseworthy deed or work done by anyone, do suppose that the man does it in the exercise of liberty. But then their notion of liberty is only a person's having opportunity of doing as he pleases. They have no notion of liberty consisting in the will's first acting, and so causing its own acts, and determining, and so causing its own determinations, or choosing, and so causing its own choice. Such a notion of liberty is what none have, but those that have darkened their own minds with confused metaphysical speculation, and abstruse and ambiguous terms. If a man is not restrained from acting as his will determines, or constrained to act otherwise, then he has liberty, according to common notions of liberty, without taking into the idea that grand contradiction of all, the determinations of a man's free will being the effects of the determinations of his free will. Nor have men commonly any notion of freedom consisting in indifference. For if so, then it would be agreeable to their notion, that the greater indifference men act with, the more freedom they act with. Whereas the reverse is true. He that, in acting, proceeds with the fullest inclination, does what he does with the greatest freedom, according to common sense. And so far is it from being agreeable to common sense, that such liberty as consists in indifference is requisite to praise or blame, that, on the contrary, the dictate of every man's natural sense through the world is, that the further he is from being indifferent in his acting good or evil, and the more he does either with full and strong inclination, the more is he esteemed or abhorred, commended or condemned. E. If it were inconsistent with the common sense of mankind, that men should be either to be blamed or commended in any volitions they have or fail of, in case of moral necessity or impossibility, then it would surely also be agreeable to the same sense and reason of mankind, that the nearer the case approaches to such a moral necessity or impossibility, either through a strong antecedent moral propensity, on the one hand, or a great antecedent opposition and difficulty on the other, the nearer does it approach to A being neither blamable nor commendable. So that acts exerted with such preceding propensity would be worthy of proportionably less praise. And when omitted, the act being attended with such difficulty, the omission would be worthy of less blame. It is so, as was observed before, with natural necessity and impossibility, propensity and difficulty, as it is a plain dictate of the sense of all mankind, that natural necessity and impossibility take away all blame and praise. And therefore, that the nearer the approach is to these, through previous propensity or difficulty, so praise and blame are proportionably diminished. And if it were as much a dictate of common sense, that moral necessity of doing or impossibility of avoiding takes away all praise and blame, as that natural necessity or impossibility does this, then, by a perfect parity of reason, it would be as much the dictate of common sense, that an approach to moral necessity of doing, or impossibility of avoiding, diminishes praise and blame, as that an approach to natural necessity and impossibility does so. It is equally the voice of common sense, that persons are excusable in part in neglecting things difficult against their wills, as that they are excusable wholly in neglecting things impossible against their wills. And if it made no difference, whether the impossibility were natural and against the will, or moral lying in the will, with regard to excusableness, so neither would it make any difference, whether the difficulty, or approach to necessity, be natural against the will, or moral, lying in the propensity of the will. But it is apparent, that the reverse of these things is true. If there be an approach to a moral necessity in a man's exertion of good acts of will, they being the exercise of a strong propensity to good, and a very powerful love to virtue, it is so far from being the dictate of common sense, that he is less virtuous, and the less to be esteemed, loved, and praised, that it is agreeable to the natural notions of all mankind, that he is so much the better man, worthy of greater respect, and higher commendation. And the stronger the inclination is, and the nearer it approaches to necessity in that respect, or to impossibility of neglecting the virtuous act, or of doing a vicious one, still the more virtuous, and worthy of higher commendation. And, on the other hand, if a man exerts evil acts of mind, as for instance, acts of pride or malice, from a rooted and strong habit or principle of hardness and maliciousness, and a violent propensity of heart to such acts, according to the natural sense of men, he is so far from being the less hateful and blamable on that account, that he is so much the more worthy to be detested and condemned by all that observe him. Moreover, it is manifest that it is no part of a notion, which mankind commonly have of a blamable or praiseworthy act of the will, that it is an act which is not determined by an antecedent bias or motive, but by the sovereign power of the will itself. Because, if so, the greater hand such causes have in determining any acts of the will, so much the less virtuous or vicious would they be accounted. And the less hand, the more virtuous or vicious. Whereas the reverse is true, men do not think a good act to be the less praiseworthy for the agents being much determined in it by a good inclination or a good motive, but the more. And if good inclination or motive has but little influence in determining the agent, they do not think his act so much the more virtuous, but the less. And so concerning evil acts, which are determined by evil motives or inclinations. Yea, if it be supposed that good or evil dispositions are implanted in the hearts of men by nature itself, which, it is certain, is vulgarly supposed in innumerable cases, yet it is not commonly supposed that men are worthy of no praise or dispraise for such dispositions. Although what is natural is undoubtedly necessary, nature being prior to all acts of the will whatsoever. Thus, For instance, if a man appears to be of a very hardy or malicious disposition, and is supposed to be so by his natural temper, it is no vulgar notion, no dictate of the common sense and apprehension of men, that such dispositions are no vices or moral evils, or that such persons are not worthy of disesteem, or odium and dishonor, or that the proud or malicious acts which flow from such natural dispositions are worthy of no resentment. Yea, such vile natural dispositions, and the strength of them, will commonly be mentioned rather as an aggravation of the wicked acts that come from such a fountain, than an extenuation of them. Its being natural for men to act thus, is often observed by men in the height of their indignation. They will say, it is his very nature. He is of a vile natural temper. It is as natural to him to act so, as it is to breathe. He cannot help serving the devil, etc. But it is not thus with regard to hurtful, mischievous things, that any are the subjects or occasions of, by natural necessity, against their inclinations. In such a case, the necessity, by the common voice of mankind, will be spoken of as a full excuse. Thus, it is very plain, that common sense makes a vast difference between these two kinds of necessity, as to the judgment it makes of their influence on the moral quality and desert of men's actions. And these dictates of men's minds are so natural and necessary, that it may be very much doubted whether the Armenians themselves have ever got rid of them. Yea, their greatest doctors, that have gone furthest in defense of their metaphysical notions of liberty, and have brought their arguments to their greatest strength, and, as they suppose, to a demonstration against the consistence of virtue and vice with any necessity. It is to be questioned whether there is so much as one of them, but that, if he suffered very much from the injurious acts of a man under the power of an invincible hardness and malignancy of temper, would not, from the forementioned natural sense of mind, resent it far otherwise than if as great sufferings came upon him from the wind that blows, and fire that burns, by natural necessity. And otherwise than he would, if he suffered as much from the conduct of a man perfectly delirious. Yea, though he first brought his distraction upon him some way by his own fault. Some seem to disdain the distinction that we make between natural and moral necessity, as though it were altogether impertinent in this controversy that which is necessary say they is necessary. It is that which must be, and cannot be prevented. And that which is impossible, and cannot be done, and therefore none can be to blame for not doing it, and such comparisons are made use of, as the commanding of a man to walk who has lost his legs, and condemning and punishing him for not obeying. Inviting and calling upon a man who is shut up in a strong prison, to come forth, etc. But, in these things, Armenians are very unreasonable. Let common sense determine whether there be not a great difference between these two cases. The one, that of a man who has offended his prince, and is cast into prison. And after he has laid there a while, the king comes to him, calls him to come forth to him, and tells him, that if he will do so, and will fall down before him, and humbly beg his pardon, he shall be forgiven and set at liberty, and also be greatly enriched, and advanced to honor. The prisoner heartily repents of the folly and wickedness of his offense against his prince, is thoroughly disposed to abase himself, and accept of the king's offer, but is confined by strong walls, with gates of brass, and bars of iron. The other case is, that of a man who is of a very unreasonable spirit, of a hardy, ungrateful, willful disposition, and, moreover, has been brought up in traitorous principles, and has his heart possessed with an extreme and inveterate enmity to his lawful sovereign, and for his rebellion is cast into prison, and lies long there, loaded with heavy chains, and in miserable circumstances. At length the compassionate prince comes to the prison, orders his chains to be knocked off, and his prison doors to be set wide open, calls to him, and tells him, if he will come forth to him, and fall down before him, acknowledge that he has treated him unworthily, and ask his forgiveness, he shall be forgiven, set at liberty, and set in a place of great dignity and profit in his court. But he is stout and stomachful, and full of hearty malignity, that he cannot be willing to accept the offer. His rooted strong pride and malice have perfect power over him, and as it were bind him. By binding his heart, the opposition of his heart has the mastery over him, having an influence on his mind far superior to the king's grace and condescension, and to all his kind offers and promises. Now, Is it agreeable to common sense to assert, and stand to it, that there is no difference between these two cases, as to any worthiness of blame in the prisoners? Because, forsooth, there is a necessity in both, and the required act in each case is impossible? It is true, a man's evil dispositions may be as strong and immovable as the bars of a castle. But who cannot see, that when a man, in the latter case, is said to be unable to obey the command, the expression is used improperly, and not in the sense it has originally, and in common speech. And that it may properly be said to be in the rebel's power to come out of prison, seeing he can easily do it if he pleases. Though by reason of his vile temper of heart, which is fixed and rooted, it is impossible that it should please him. Upon the whole, I presume there is no person of good understanding, who impartially considers the things which have been observed, but will allow, that it is not evident, from the dictates of the common sense, or natural notions of mankind, that moral necessity is inconsistent with praise and blame. And, therefore, if the Armenians would prove any such inconsistency, it must be by some philosophical and metaphysical arguments, and not common sense. There is a grand illusion in the pretended demonstration of Armenians from common sense. The main strength of all these demonstrations lies in their prejudice, that arises through the insensible change of the use and meaning of such terms as liberty, able, unable, necessary, impossible, unavoidable, invincible, action, etc., from their original and vulgar sense, to a metaphysical sense, entirely diverse. And the strong connection of the ideas of blamelessness, etc., with some of these terms, by a habit contracted and established while these terms were used in their first meaning. This prejudice and delusion is the foundation of all those positions they lay down as maxims, by which most of the scriptures, which they allege in this controversy, are interpreted, and on which all their pompous demonstrations from scripture and reason depend. From this secret delusion and prejudice they have almost all their advantages. It is the strength of their bulwarks, and the edge of their weapons. And this is the main ground of all the right they have to treat their neighbors in so assuming a manner, and to insult others, perhaps as wise and good as themselves, as weak bigots, men that dwell in the dark caves of superstition, perversely set, obstinately shutting their eyes against the noonday light, enemies to common sense, maintaining the firstborn of absurdities, etc., etc., but perhaps an impartial consideration of the things which have been observed in the preceding parts of this inquiry, may enable the lovers of truth better to judge, whose doctrine is indeed absurd, abstruse, self-contradictory, and inconsistent with common sense, and many ways repugnant to the universal dictates of the reason of mankind. Corollary. From things which have been observed, it will follow, that it is agreeable to common sense to suppose that the glorified saints have not their freedom at all diminished in any respect and that God himself has the highest possible freedom according to the true and proper meaning of the term. And that he is, in the highest possible respect, an agent and active in the exercise of his infinite holiness. Though he acts therein, in the highest degree necessarily and his actions of this kind, are in the highest, most absolutely perfect manner, virtuous and praiseworthy. And are so, for that very reason, because they are most perfectly necessary. Section V. Concerning those objections, that this scheme of necessity renders all means and endeavors for the avoiding of sin, or the obtaining virtue and holiness, vain and to no purpose. And that it makes men no more than mere machines in affairs of morality and religion. Armenians say, if it be so, that sin and virtue come to pass by a necessity consisting in a sure connection of causes and effects, antecedents and consequence, it can never be worth the while to use any means or endeavors to obtain the one, and avoid the other. Seeing no endeavors can alter the futurity of the event, which is become necessary by a connection already established, but I desire that this matter may be fully considered, and that it may be examined with a thorough strictness, whether it will follow, that endeavors and means, in order to avoid or obtain any future thing, must be more in vain, on the supposition of such a connection of antecedents and consequence than if the contrary be supposed. For endeavors to be in vain, is for them not to be successful. That is to say, for them not eventually to be the means of the thing aimed at, which cannot be but in one of these two ways. Either, first, that although the means are used, yet the event aimed at does not follow. Or, secondly, if the event does follow, it is not because of the means, or from any connection or dependence of the event on the means. The event would have come to pass as well without the means as with them. If either of these two things is the case, then the means are not properly successful, and are truly in vain. The successfulness or unsuccessfulness of means, in order to an effect, or their being in vain or not in vain, consists in those means being connected or not connected with the effect, in such a manner as this, namely that the effect is with the means, and not without them. Or, that the being of the effect is, on the one hand, connected with means, and the want of the effect, on the other hand, is connected with the want of the means. If there be such a connection, as this between means and end, the means are not in vain. The more there is of such a connection, the further they are from being in vain. And the less of such a connection, the more they are in vain. Now, therefore, the question to be answered, in order to determine whether it follows from this doctrine of the necessary connection between foregoing things and consequent ones, that means used in order to any effect are more in vain than they would be otherwise, is, whether it follows from it that there is less of the aforementioned connection between means and effect. That is, whether, on the supposition of there being a real and true connection between means and effect, than on the supposition of there being no fixed connection between antecedent things and consequent ones. And the very stating of this question is sufficient to answer it. It must appear to everyone that will open his eyes, that this question cannot be affirmed without the grossest absurdity and inconsistency. Means are foregoing things, and effects are following things. And if there were no connection between foregoing things and following ones, there could be no connection between means and end. And so all means would be wholly vain and fruitless. For it is by virtue of some connection only, that they become successful. It is some connection observed or revealed, or otherwise known, between antecedent things and following ones, that is what directs in the choice of means. And if there were no such thing as an established connection, there could be no choice as to means. One thing would have no more tendency to an effect than another. There would be no such thing as tendency in the case. All those things which are successful means of other things, do therein prove connected antecedents of them. And therefore, to assert that a fixed connection between antecedents and consequence makes means vain and useless, or stands in the way to hinder the connection between means and end, is just as ridiculous as to say that a connection between antecedents and consequence stands in the way to hinder a connection between antecedents and consequence. Nor can any supposed connection of the succession or train of antecedents and consequence, from the very beginning of all things, the connection being made already sure and necessary, either by established laws of nature, or by these together with a decree of sovereign immediate interpositions of divine power, on such and such occasions, or any other way if any other there be. I say, no such necessary connection of a series of antecedents and consequence can in the least tend to hinder, but that the means we use may belong to the series. And so may be some of those antecedents which are connected with the consequence we aim at in the established course of things. Endeavors which we use, are things that exist. And therefore they belong to the general chain of events. All the parts of which chain are supposed to be connected. And so endeavors are supposed to be connected with some effects, or some consequent things or other. And certainly this does not hinder but that the events they are connected with, may be those which we aim at, and which we choose, because we judge them most likely to have a connection with those events from the established order and course of things which we observe, or from something in divine revelation. Let us suppose a real and true connection between a man's having his eyes open in the clear daylight, with good organs of sight, and seeing. So that seeing is connected with his opening his eyes, and not seeing with his not opening his eyes. And also the like connection between such a man's attempting to open his eyes, and his actually doing it, the supposed established connection between these antecedents and consequence, let the connection be never so sure and necessary, certainly does not prove that it is in vain for a man in such circumstances to attempt to open his eyes, in order to seeing his aiming at that event, and the use of the means, being the effect of his will, does not break the connection, or hinder the success, so that the objection we are upon does not lie against the doctrine of the necessity of events by a certainty of connection and consequence. On the contrary, it is truly forcible against the Armenian doctrine of contingence and self-determination, which is inconsistent with such a connection. If there be no connection between those events wherein virtue and vice consist, and anything antecedent, then there is no connection between these events and any means or endeavors used in order to them. And if so, then those means must be in vain. The less there is of connection between foregoing things and following ones, so much the less there is between means and end, endeavors and success. And in the same proportion are means and endeavors ineffectual and in vain. It will follow from Armenian principles that there is no degree of connection between virtue or vice, in any foregoing event or thing. Or, in other words, that the determination of the existence of virtue or vice does not in the least depend on the influence of anything that comes to pass antecedently, from which the determination of its existence is, as its cause, means, or ground. Because so far as it is so, it is not from self-determination. And, therefore, so far there is nothing of the nature of virtue or vice. And so it follows, that virtue and vice are not at all, in any degree, dependent upon, or connected with, any foregoing event or existence, as its cause, ground, or means. And if so, then all foregoing means must be totally in vain. Hence it follows, that there cannot, in any consistence with the Armenian scheme, be any reasonable ground of so much as a conjecture concerning the consequence of any means and endeavors, in order to escaping vice, or obtaining virtue, or any choice or preference of means, as having a greater probability of success by some than others. Either from any natural connection or dependence of the end on the means, or through any divine constitution, or revealed way of God's bestowing or bringing to pass these things, in consequence of any means, endeavors, prayers, or deeds. Conjectures in this latter case depend on a supposition that God Himself is the giver, or determining cause, of the events sought. But if they depend on self-determination, then God is not the determining or disposing author of them. And if these things are not of His disposal, then no conjecture can be made, from any revelation He has given, concerning any way or method of His disposal of them. Yea, on these principles, it will not only follow, that men cannot have any reasonable ground of judgment or conjecture that their means and endeavors to obtain virtue, or avoid vice, will be successful, but they may be sure they will not. They may be certain that they will be in vain. And that if ever the thing, which they seek, comes to pass, it will not be at all owing to the means they use. For means and endeavors can have no effect at all, in order to obtain the end, but in one of those two ways. Either one through a natural tendency and influence to prepare and dispose the mind more to virtuous acts, either by causing the disposition of the heart to be more in favor of such acts, or by bringing the mind more into the view of powerful motives and inducements. Or, two, by putting persons more in the way of God's bestowment of the benefit. But neither of these can be the case. Not the latter. For, as has been just observed, it does not consist with the Armenian notion of self-determination, which they suppose essential to virtue, that God should be the best hour, or which is the same thing the determining disposing author of virtue. Not the form. For natural influence and tendency supposes causality and connection, and supposes necessity of event, which is inconsistent with Armenian liberty. A tendency of means, by biasing the heart in favor of virtue, or by bringing the will under the influence and power of motives in its determinations, are both inconsistent with Armenian liberty of will, consisting in indifference, and sovereign self-determination, as has been largely demonstrated. But for the more full removal of this prejudice against the doctrine of necessity, which has been maintained, as though it tended to encourage a total neglect of all endeavors as vain, the following things may be considered. The question is not, whether man may not thus improve this doctrine. We know that many true and wholesome doctrines are abused. But, whether the doctrine gives any just occasion for such an improvement, or whether, on the supposition of the truth of the doctrine, such a use of it would be unreasonable? If any shall affirm, that it would not, but that the very nature of the doctrine is such as gives just occasion for it, it must be on the supposition, namely, that such an invariable necessity of all things already settled, must render the interposition of all means, endeavors, conclusions, or actions of ours, in order to the obtaining any future end whatsoever, perfectly insignificant because they cannot in the least alter or vary the course and series of things, in any event or circumstance, all being already fixed unutterably by necessity, and that therefore it is folly for men to use any means for any end, but their wisdom to save themselves the trouble of endeavors, and take their ease. No person can draw such an inference from this doctrine, and come to such a conclusion, without contradicting himself, and going counter to the very principles he pretends to act upon. For he comes to a conclusion and takes a course, in order to an end, even his case, or the saving himself from trouble he seeks something future, and uses means in order to a future thing, even in his drawing up that conclusion, that he will seek nothing, and use no means in order to anything in future. He seeks his future ease, and the benefit and comfort of indolence. If prior necessity, that determines all things, makes vain all actions or conclusions of ours, in order to anything future, then it makes vain all conclusions and conduct of ours, in order to our future ease. The measure of our ease, with the time, manner, and every circumstance of it, is already fixed, by all determining necessity, as much as anything else. If he says within himself, what future happiness or misery I shall have, is already, in effect, determined by the necessary course and connection of things. Therefore, I will save myself the trouble of labor and diligence which cannot add to my determined degree of happiness, or diminish my misery, but will take my ease, and will enjoy the comfort of sloth and negligence. Such a man contradicts himself. He says, the measure of his future happiness and misery is already fixed, and he will not try to diminish the one, nor add to the other. But yet, in his very conclusion, he contradicts this. For, he takes up this conclusion, to add to his future happiness, by the ease and comfort of his negligence, and to diminish his future trouble and misery by saving himself the trouble of using means and taking pains. Therefore, persons cannot reasonably make this improvement of the doctrine of necessity, that they will go into voluntary negligence of means for their own happiness. For the principles they must go upon, in order to this, are inconsistent with their making any improvement at all of the doctrine. For to make some improvement of it, is to be influenced by it, to come to some voluntary conclusion, in regard to their own conduct, with some view or aim. But this, as has been shown, is inconsistent with the principles they pretend to act upon. In short, the principles are such as cannot be acted upon at all, or, in any respect, consistently. And therefore, in every pretense of acting upon them, or making any improvement at all of them, there is a self-contradiction. As to that objection against the doctrine, which I have endeavored to prove, that it makes men no more than mere machines, I would say, that notwithstanding this doctrine, man is entirely, perfectly, and unspeakably different from a mere machine, in that he has reason and understanding, and has a faculty of will, and is so capable of volition and choice, and in that his will is guided by the dictates or views of his understanding, and in that his external actions and behavior, and in many respects also his thoughts, and the exercises of his mind, are subject to his will, so that he has liberty to act according to his choice, and do what he pleases, and, by means of these things, is capable of moral habits and moral acts, such inclinations and actions, as, according to the common sense of mankind, are worthy of praise, esteem, love, and reward, or, on the contrary, of disesteem, detestation, indignation, and punishment. In these things is all the difference from mere machines, as to liberty and agency, that would be any perfection, dignity, or privilege, in any respect. All the difference that can be desired, and all that can be conceived of. And indeed all that the pretensions of the Armenians themselves come to, as they are forced often to explain themselves. Though their explications overthrow and abolish the things asserted, and pretended to be explained, for they are forced to explain a self-determining power of will, by a power in the soul to determine as it chooses or wills. Which comes to no more than this, that a man has a power of choosing, and in many instances, can do as he chooses, which is quite a different thing from that contradiction, his having power of choosing his first act of choice in the case. Or, If their scheme makes any other difference than this between men and machines, it is for the worse. It is so far from supposing men to have a dignity and privilege above machines, that it makes the manner of their being determined still more unhappy. Whereas machines are guided by an understanding cause, by the skillful hand of the workman or owner. The will of man is left to the guidance of nothing but absolute blind contingence. Section VI. Concerning that objection against the doctrine which has been maintained, that it agrees with the Stoical doctrine of faith, and the opinions of Mr. Hobbes. When Calvinists oppose the Arminian notion of the freedom of will, and contingence of volition, and insist that there are no acts of the will, nor any other event whatsoever, but what are attended with some kind of necessity. Their opposers cry out against them, as agreeing with the ancient Stoics in their doctrine of fate, and with Mr. Hobbes in his opinion of necessity. It would not be worthwhile to take notice of so impertinent an objection, had it not been urged by some of the chief Arminian writers. There were many important truths maintained by the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, and especially the Stoics, that are never the worse for being held by them. The Stoic philosophers, by the general agreement of Christian divines, and even Armenian divines, were the greatest, wisest, and most virtuous of all the heathen philosophers. And in their doctrine and practice came the nearest to Christianity of any of their sects. How frequently are the sayings of these philosophers, in many of the writings and sermons, even of Armenian divines, produced, not as arguments of the falseness of the doctrines which they delivered, but as a confirmation of some of the greatest truths of the Christian religion, relating to the unity and perfections of the Godhead, of future state, the duty and happiness of mankind, etc., as observing how the light of nature, and reason, in the wisest and best of the heathen, harmonized with and confirms the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it is very remarkable, concerning Dr. Whitby, that although he alleges the agreement of the Stoics with us, wherein he supposes they maintain the like doctrine with us, as an argument against the truth of our doctrine. Yet this very Dr. Whitby alleges the agreement of the Stoics with the Armenians, wherein he supposes they taught the same doctrine with them, as an argument for the truth of their doctrine. So that, when the Stoics agree with them, this it seems is a confirmation of their doctrine, and a confutation of ours, as showing that our opinions are contrary to the natural sense and common reason of mankind. Nevertheless, when the Stoics agree with us, it argues no such thing in our favor. But, on the contrary, is a great argument against us, and shows our doctrine to be heathenish. It is observed by some Calvinistic writers, that the Armenians symbolize with the Stoics in some of those doctrines wherein they are opposed by the Calvinists. Particularly in their denying an original, innate, total corruption and depravity of heart. And in what they held of man's ability to make himself truly virtuous and conform to God. And in some other doctrines. It may be further observed, it is certainly no better objection against our doctrine, that it agrees, in some respects, with the doctrine of the ancient Stoic philosophers, than it is against theirs, wherein they differ from us, that it agrees, in some respects, with the opinion of the very worst of the heathen philosophers, the followers of Epicurus, that father of atheism and licentiousness, and with the doctrine of the Sadducees and Jesuits. I am not much concerned to know precisely what the ancient Stoic philosophers held concerning fate, in order to determine what is truth. As though it were a sure way to be in the right, to take good heed to differ from them. It seems that they differed among themselves. And probably the doctrine of fate, as maintained by most of them, was, in some respects, erroneous. But whatever their doctrine was, if any of them held such a fate as is repugnant to any liberty, consisting in our doing as we please, I utterly deny such a fate. If they held any such fate as is not consistent with the common and universal notions that mankind have of liberty, activity, moral agency, virtue and vice, I disclaim any such thing, and think I have demonstrated that the scheme I maintain is no such scheme. If the Stoics, by fate, meant anything of such a nature as can be supposed to stand in the way of the advantage and benefit of the use of means and endeavors, or make it less worth the while for men to desire and seek after anything wherein their virtue and happiness consists, I hold no doctrine that is clogged with any such inconvenience, any more than any other scheme whatsoever. And by no means so much as the Armenian scheme of contingence. as has been shown. If they held any such doctrine of universal fatality as is inconsistent with any kind of liberty, that is, or can be any perfection, dignity, privilege or benefit, or anything desirable, in any respect, for any intelligent creature, or indeed with any liberty that is possible or conceivable, I embrace no such doctrine. If they held any such doctrine of fate as is inconsistent with the world's being in all things subject to the disposal of an intelligent wise agent, that presides, not as the soul of the world, but as the sovereign lord of the universe, governing all things by proper will, choice, and design, in the exercise of the most perfect liberty conceivable, without subjection to any constraint, or being properly under the power or influence of anything before, above, or without himself, I wholly renounce any such doctrine. As to Mr. Hobbes is maintaining the same doctrine concerning necessity, I confess it happens I never read Mr. Hobbes. Let his opinion be what it will, we need not reject all truth which is demonstrated by clear evidence, merely because it was once held by some bad man. This great truth, that Jesus is the Son of God, was not spoiled because it was once and again proclaimed with a loud voice by the devil. If truth is so defiled, because it is spoken by the mouth, or written by the pen, of some ill-minded mischievous man, that it must never be received, we shall never know when we hold any of the most precious and evident truths by a sure tenure. And if Mr. Hobbes has made a bad use of this truth, that is to be lamented. But the truth is not to be thought worthy of rejection on that account. It is common for the corruptions of the hearts of evil men to abuse the best things to vile purposes. I might also take notice of its having been observed that the Armenians agree with Mr. Hobbes in many more things than the Calvinists. As, in what he is said to hold concerning original sin, in denying the necessity of supernatural illumination, in denying infused grace, in denying the doctrine of justification by faith alone, and other things. Section V. Concerning the necessity of the divine will. Some may possibly object against what has been supposed of the absurdity and inconsistence of a self-determining power in the will, and the impossibility of its being otherwise than that the will should be determined in every case by some motive, and by a motive which as it stands in the view of the understanding is of superior strength to any appearing on the other side. That if these things are true, it will follow that not only the will of created minds, but the will of God himself, is necessary in all its determinations. Concerning which, says the author of the Essay on the Freedom of Will in God and in the Creature, pages 85, 86, what strange doctrine is this, contrary to all our ideas of the dominion of God? Does it not destroy the glory of his liberty of choice, and take away from the Creator and Governor and Benefactor of the world, that most free and sovereign agent, all the glory of this sort of freedom? Does it not seem to make him a kind of mechanical medium of fate, and introduce Mr. Hobbes' doctrine of fatality and necessity into all things that God hath to do with? Does it not seem to represent the blessed God as a being of vast understanding, as well as power and efficiency, but still to leave him without a will to choose among all the objects within his view? In short, it seems to make the blessed God a sort of almighty minister of fate, under its universal and supreme influence. As it was the professed sentiment of some of the ancients, that fate was above the gods. This is declaiming, rather than arguing, and an application to men's imaginations and prejudices, rather than to mere reason. But I would calmly endeavor to consider whether there be any reason in this frightful representation, but before I enter upon a particular consideration of the matter, I should observe this, that it is reasonable to suppose it should be much more difficult to express or conceive things according to exact metaphysical truth, relating to the nature and manner of the existence of things in the divine understanding and will, and the operation of these faculties, if I may so call them, of the divine mind, than in the human mind, which is infinitely more within our view, and nearer to a proportion to the measure of our comprehension, and more commensurate to the use and import of human speech. Language is indeed very deficient in regard of terms to express precise truth concerning our own minds, and their faculties and operations. Words were first formed to express external things. And those that are applied to express things internal and spiritual, are almost all borrowed, and used in a sort of figurative sense. Whence they are, most of them, attended with a great deal of ambiguity and unfixedness in their signification, occasioning innumerable doubts, difficulties, and confusions, in inquiries and controversies about things of this nature. But language is much less adapted to express things in the mind of the incomprehensible deity precisely as they are. We find a great deal of difficulty in conceiving exactly of the nature of our own souls. And notwithstanding all the progress which has been made, in past and present ages, in this kind of knowledge, whereby our metaphysics, as it relates to these things, is brought to greater perfection than once it was. Yet, here is still work enough left for future inquiries and researches, and room for progress still to be made, for many ages and generations. But we had need to be infinitely able metaphysicians, to conceive with clearness, according to strict, proper, and perfect truth, concerning the nature of the divine essence, and the modes of the action and operation of the powers of the divine mind. And it may be noted particularly, that though we are obliged to conceive of some things in God as consequent and dependent on others, and of some things pertaining to the divine nature and will as the foundation of others, and so before others in the order of nature, as we must conceive of the knowledge and holiness of God as prior, in the order of nature, to his happiness, the perfection of his understanding, as the foundation of his wise purposes and decrees, the holiness of his nature, as the cause and reason of his holy determinations. And yet, when we speak of cause and effect, antecedent and consequent, fundamental and dependent, determining and determined, in the first being, who is self-existent, independent, of perfect and absolute simplicity and immutability, and the first cause of all things, doubtless there must be less propriety in such representations than when we speak of derived dependent beings, who are compounded and liable to perpetual mutation and succession. Having premised this, I proceed to observe concerning the forementioned author's exclamation about the necessary determination of God's will, in all things, by what he sees to be fittest and best, that all the seeming force of such objections and exclamations must arise from an imagination that there is some sort of privilege or dignity in being without such a moral necessity as will make it impossible to do any other than always choose what is wisest and best. As though there were some disadvantage, meanness, and subjection, in such a necessity. A thing by which the will was confined, kept under, and held in servitude by something, which, as it were, maintained a strong and invincible power and dominion over it, by bonds that held him fast, and that he could, by no means, deliver himself from. Whereas, this must be all mere imagination and delusion. It is no disadvantage or dishonor to a being, necessarily to act in the most excellent and happy manner, from the necessary perfection of his own nature. This argues no imperfection, inferiority, or dependence, nor any want of dignity, privilege, or ascendancy. It is not inconsistent with the absolute and most perfect sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God is his ability and authority to do whatever pleases him, whereby he doth according to his will in the armies of heaven, and amongst the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand, or say unto him, What dost thou? The following things belong to the sovereignty of God, namely one supreme, universal, and infinite power whereby he is able to do what he pleases, without control, without any confinement of that power, without any subjection, in the least measure, to any other power. And so without any hindrance or restraint, that it should be either impossible, or at all difficult, for him to accomplish his will. And without any dependence of his power on any other power, from whence it should be derived, or which it should stand in any need of. So far from this, that all other power is derived from him, and is absolutely dependent on him. 2. That he has supreme authority, absolute and most perfect right to do what he wills, without subjection to any superior authority, or any derivation of authority from any other, or limitation by any distinct independent authority, either superior, equal, or inferior. He being the head of all dominion, and fountain of all authority, and also without restraint by any obligation, implying either subjection, derivation, or dependence, or proper limitation. 3. That his will is supreme, underived, and independent on anything without himself, being in everything determined by his own counsel, having no other rule but his own wisdom, his will not being subject to, or restrained by, the will of any other, and other wills being perfectly subject to his. 4. That is wisdom, which determines his will, is supreme, perfect, underived, self-sufficient, and independent. So that it may be said, as in Isaiah 40:14, with whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding. There is no other divine sovereignty but this. And this is properly absolute sovereignty, no other is desirable. Nor would any other be honorable or happy, and, indeed, there is no other conceivable or possible. It is the glory and greatness of the divine sovereign, that God's will is determined by his own infinite, all-sufficient wisdom in everything. And in nothing at all is either directed by any inferior wisdom, or by no wisdom. Whereby it would become senseless arbitrariness, determining and acting without reason, design, or end. If God's will is steadily and surely determined in everything by supreme wisdom, then it is in everything necessarily determined to that which is most wise. And, certainly, it would be a disadvantage and indignity to be otherwise. For if the divine will was not necessarily determined to that which, in every case, is wisest and best, it must be subject to some degree of undesigning contingence. And so in the same degree liable to evil to suppose the divine will liable to be carried hither and thither at random, by the uncertain wind of blind contingence, which is guided by no wisdom, no motive, no intelligent dictate whatsoever, if any such thing were possible, would certainly argue a great degree of imperfection and meanness, infinitely unworthy of the Deity. If it be a disadvantage for the divine will to be attended with this moral necessity, then the more free from it, and the more left at random, the greater dignity and advantage. And, consequently, to be perfectly free from the direction of understanding, and universally and entirely left to senseless, unmeaning contingents, to act absolutely at random, would be the supreme glory. It no more argues any dependence of God's will, that his supremely wise volition is necessary, than it argues a dependence of his being, that his existence is necessary. If it be something too low for the supreme being to have his will determined by moral necessity, so as necessarily, in every case, to will in the highest degree wholly and happily, then why is it not also something too low for him to have his existence, and the infinite perfection of his nature, and his infinite happiness, determined by necessity? It is no more to God's discerner to be necessarily wise, than to be necessarily holy. And if neither of them be to his discerner, then it is not to his discerner necessarily to act holily and wisely. And if it be not dishonorable to be necessarily holy and wise, in the highest possible degree, no more is it mean and dishonorable, necessarily to act holily and wisely in the highest possible degree. Or, which is the same thing, to do that, in every case, which, above all other things, is wisest and best. The reason why it is not dishonorable to be necessarily most holy, is, because holiness in itself is an excellent and honorable thing. For the same reason, it is no dishonor to be necessarily most wise, and, in every case, to act most wisely, or do the thing which is the wisest of all. For wisdom is also in itself excellent and honorable. The forementioned author of the Essay on the Freedom of Will, etc., as has been observed, represents that doctrine of the divine wills being in everything necessarily determined by a superior fitness, as making the blessed God a kind of almighty minister and mechanical medium of fate. And he insists, pages 93, 94, that this moral necessity and impossibility is, in effect, the same thing with physical and natural necessity and impossibility. And in pages 54, 55, he says, the scheme which determines the will always and certainly by the understanding, and understanding by the appearance of things, seems to take away the true nature of vice and virtue. For the sublimest of virtues, and the vilest of vices, seem rather to be matters of fate and necessity, flowing naturally and necessarily from the existence, the circumstances, and present situation of persons and things. For this existence and situation necessarily makes such an appearance to the mind. From this appearance flows a necessary perception and judgment concerning these things. This judgment necessarily determines the will. And thus, by this chain of necessary causes, virtue and vice would lose their nature, and become natural ideas, and necessary things, instead of moral and free actions. And yet this same author allows, pages 30, 31, that a perfectly wise being will constantly and certainly choose what is most fit. And says, pages 102, 103, I grant, and always have granted, that wheresoever there is such antecedent superior fitness of things, God acts according to it, so as never to contradict it. And, particularly, in all his judicial proceedings as a governor and distributor of rewards and punishments. Yea, he says expressly, pages 42, that it is not possible for God to act otherwise than according to this fitness and goodness in things. So that, according to this author, putting these several passages of this essay together, there is no virtue, nor anything of a moral nature, in the most sublime and glorious acts and exercises of God's holiness, justice, and faithfulness. And he never does anything which is in itself supremely worthy, and, above all other things, fit and excellent, but only as a kind of mechanical medium of fate. And in what he does as the judge and moral governor of the world, he exercises no moral excellency, exercising no freedom in these things, because he acts by moral necessity, which is, in effect, the same with physical or natural necessity. And therefore he only acts by an hobbistical fatality. As a being indeed of vast understanding, as well as power and efficiency, as he said before, but without a will to choose, being a kind of almighty administrator of fate, acting under its supreme influence. For he allows, that in all these things, God's will is determined constantly and certainly by a superior fitness, and that it is not possible for him to act otherwise. And if these things are so, what glory or praise belongs to God for doing holily and justly? Or taking the most fit, holy, wise, and excellent course, in any one instance? Whereas, according to the Scriptures, and also the common sense of mankind, it does not, in the least, derogate from the honor of any being, that through the moral perfection of his nature he necessarily acts with supreme wisdom and holiness. But on the contrary, his praise is the greater. Herein consists the height of his glory. The same author, pages 56, supposes that herein appears the excellent character of a wise and good man, that though he can choose contrary to the fitness of things, yet he does not, but suffers himself to be directed by fitness. And that, in this conduct, he imitates the blessed God. And yet he supposes it is contrariwise with the blessed God. Not that he suffers himself to be directed by fitness, when he can choose, contrary to the fitness of things, but that he cannot choose contrary to the fitness of things. As he says, pages 42, that it is not possible for God to act otherwise than according to this fitness, where there is any fitness or goodness in things. Yea, he supposes, pages 31, that if a man were perfectly wise and good, he could not do otherwise than be constantly and certainly determined by the fitness of things. One thing more I would observe, before I conclude this section. And that is, that if it derogates nothing from the glory of God to be necessarily determined by superior fitness in some things, then neither does it to be thus determined in all things. From anything in the nature of such necessity, as at all detracting from God's freedom, independence, absolute supremacy, or any dignity or glory of his nature, state, or manner of acting, or as implying any infirmity, restraint, or subjection. And if the thing be such as well consists with God's glory, and has nothing tending at all to detract from it, then we need not be afraid of ascribing it to God in too many things, lest thereby we should detract from God's glory too much.